Welcome to Coach's Corner, sponsored by Front Rush. Hear from coaches across all sports and divisions talk about what winning means to them. Every coach has a story, and we're here to help tell it. In our first episode, we'll hear from Coach Todd Brown, head baseball coach at North Dakota State. Todd tells us what having grit means to him and how sticking to the grind has paid off throughout his career. Thank you for listening to Coach's Corner, brought to you by Front Rush.
So today my guest is Todd Brown. Coach Brown is in his 11th year as the head coach of the North Dakota State University Bison baseball team. Under Coach Brown, the Bison have played in four Summit League championship games, qualified for the league's baseball championship six out of the last 7 years. His team has won the Summit League tournament, and they won it in 2014. His teams have set school records and wins with 40, and Summit League games won with 19. He's coached over 21 athletes who have signed professional contracts. As a player, Coach Brown was a left-handed pitcher at the University of Arizona, where he was a member of the 1992 Pac-10 championship team. He set Arizona's single-season record with 35 mound appearances and was named to the All-Midwest regional team. That year, the Wildcats fell one run shy of a College World Series appearance. Coach Brown then went on to sign a free agent deal with the Cleveland Indians, but suffered a career-ending arm injury and then made his way into coaching. You know, you had an impressive resume as a coach. You had an impressive resume as a player. But one thing that people may not know about you is you're not gifted with, you know, great size. You didn't have overpowering velocity as a left-handed pitcher, but you were amazingly successful. You know, you fought through some obstacles and showed perseverance to get to a point to be a, you know, an integral part of the Arizona pitching staff. If you could kind of place it, where does that kind of grit come from? You know, a lot of kids want to just mail it in, you know, get overwhelmed again by the moment as a player. Where does that grit come from for you?
To be honest with you, it happened in all my sports where I wasn't looked at as the best guy. And I wanted to be the best guy since I've been 5-6 years old. And I guess I could summarize it. What I tell people is I tried harder and cared more than most. And I think that's what drove me, was having those two things is, you know, you could see guys that were 6'1" in eighth grade and shaving, and I was 110 pounds, but I had to compete against those guys. And then once I started getting closer to their size and weight, I already had the skills necessary, the fundamental skills to survive when I was smaller than those guys. And once I started getting closer to their size and weight, I really started making a move and being more consistent. Whether it was soccer or football or baseball, all the sports that I played, because now I had that grit and everything already, you know, instilled for the previous 10 years because I was smaller and not as talented as other guys, and I had to work harder and be smarter. And, you know, those are the things that when you watch a major league pitcher, those guys are fundamentally sound, they're tough, they're gritty, but their talent is through the roof. That's what makes a major league player, is having all of those things put together. The guy with talent but no work ethic, no grit, no drive, those guys aren't in the major leagues. And sometimes you can have all the toughness, grit, fundamentals that you want, but your talent is short. Those guys are in the minor leagues and get washed out. So that's what's really impressive, is watching major league baseball, because you have to have the total package in order to get to the major leagues and stay in the major leagues. And really, I thought I had it all except the talent part. My velocity and velocity was just not in the range that was going to be successful at the high levels, and that's how I washed out.
Looking at your bio and knowing you and looking at your experience, obviously now you're an experienced head coach, proven processes, philosophies. I want to dive into all that, but going back almost 20 years ago, you were a young assistant coach at Arizona, and you received an opportunity to be a head coach for the San Francisco Seals, the California Coastal Collegiate League, and ended up making a fourth place finish in the National Baseball Congress World Series, which seems like quite an accomplishment, especially for a first brand new head coach. How did you get the first opportunity to be this head coach? so young and this opportunity coming from being an assistant in Arizona?
Yeah, I think I was 26 at the time, and it was a, you know, being at an assistant at Arizona really provided some opportunities to get your resume in front of people. And that's usually what happens is you go work for these Woodbat Collegiate Summer Leagues as a young coach to get experience so that you can turn that into, kind of parlay that into full-time jobs at the Division I level. And just provided an opportunity, you know, to get my resume in front of some of the right people that were making decisions, and they hired me. And so I go out, and we had a really good team. We had a few guys from UCLA, USC, Mississippi State, Kansas State, you know, all over the country. We had some really, really talented players. We played 72 game schedule. Probably one of the highlights is we went in and played the San Quentin Giants, which was the prison team. So went into San Quentin to play the prison team was pretty cool, but it provided some opportunities for me to learn as a coach, you know, through trial and error, and surrounded myself with some good assistant coaches. And before you know it, we're going to the national, the NBC World Series as a, we won the qualifier in San Diego and ended up finishing fourth. And that thing was quite an accomplishment. And I look back on a lot of fond memories and growth as a coach during that summer.
So, you know, it seems to me, from an outsider's perspective, that would be pretty daunting for a new young coach. You know, how did you kind of take that challenge and not let it overwhelm you? Was it, you mentioned you hired some good assistants, you had some good players, but kind of, did you have a recipe, or were you just kind of playing it by ear? What was the idea to not let that moment overwhelm you?
Well, the on the field stuff is the easy part. A lot of people probably overanalyze that a little bit. Once you get yourself in a uniform and the game starts, you know, whether you're going to bunt, hit and run, or take out a pitcher, I wouldn't say that's easy stuff, but it's stuff that you've been doing and looking at as a player for so long. I didn't really have any issues making adjustments there. Did I make mistakes? Yeah. Did I learn from maybe pulling a pitcher too early or too late? Those are all things that by trial and error that all coaches go through. But really, the most overwhelming part was all the paperwork and posting a lineup, filling out a lineup properly, you know, umpires meetings, ground rules, having batting practice organized, all your pregame stuff, paperwork all organized. Those are things that I've never really been thrown into. And that was probably the biggest learning curve was all the stuff done before the first pitch. Once the first pitch, then it was more natural, so to speak.
We talk about baseball being a really cerebral game and really mental game. How much of your intelligence of the game came into play to make up for any lack of physicality? And I'm talking more on the level of when you were, you know, pitching in the Pac-10. This is early 90s, Pac-10, arguably one of the strongest, if not the strongest baseball conference in D1. You're going against these D1 hitters, right? And how much of your intelligence and student of the game studying hitters or, you know, just knowing the right pitch, right moment, being coachable, how did that play along with the physical limitations that may have existed?
Well, I think it was a big part. You know, I think we had really talented coaches, with Jerry Kendall being my head coach and Jerry Stitt our hitting coach and Jim Wing our pitching coach. You know, for the most part, they were calling pitches and putting guys in situations. Coach Kendall put the pitchers into the game in situations they felt like they could handle. Jim Wing was calling pitches and obviously making some moves or advising moves as well. So I think that being a student of the game was a big part of my game, is being smart and throwing the pitches at the right time, being able to hold base runners, being fundamentally sound and fielding my position. All these things gave me an advantage. And what didn't give me advantage was my overall stuff was, if you graded it, it graded below a Pac-10 level probably. And how did I survive is, you know, the will to win, putting my fundamentals together along with making the right pitch at the right time, a little bit of luck. I think they did a good job of, a lot of times when I pitched, I would follow a right-handed pitcher, that was a hard thrower. So all of a sudden you got a guy throwing 92, 94 like Tim Schweitzer or Mike Scheifelbein. And then I came in throwing low to mid 80s with a changeup, was totally a different look. And I think that combination really helped, was a good combination for me because they were so drastically different. Yeah. But, you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to, you know, head, heart, guts, and nuts is what I tell everybody. You know, if you have the head to do the right things, you have the heart because you have a strong desire, you have the guts, and the nuts is just the will to want to compete and do well. I think you put all those together, that can overcome a lot of your shortcomings that you have in talent.
So you mentioned Jerry Kendall. Obviously, you played for a Hall of Fame coach in Jerry Kendall at the University of Arizona. You coached the pitchers for Coach Danny Schmitz at Bowling Green. He now has 700 wins. What were the kind of the most important things you learned from these coaches that helped mold your coaching philosophy?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, starting at Arizona, Coach Kendall and his staff did such a good job of treating guys. They were not yellers and screamers, and they treated everybody with a lot of respect. And they were so hung up on doing things the right way, playing the game the right way, and fundamentally sound that, you know, it was day in and day out, those things were preached to us. And obviously, I think that was probably one of the biggest influences on my coaching career is just how to run a program the right way, how to treat kids the right way. You know, going to Bowling Green, Danny Schmitz was a totally different style than I've ever been a part of. He's a lot more aggressive and fiery with umpires and players. But, you know, there was something about that worked for a lot of the players that we recruited. So I took a little bit of that, and I took a little bit of Coach Kendall and a little bit of different coaches that I've and kind of rolled it into my philosophy. And I think it reflects a lot of what the University of Minnesota does, what the University of Arizona does, and the reason why is because Dick Siebert is a longtime Minnesota coach. Coach Kendall and Coach Anderson there, the head coach at Minnesota. And when we play Minnesota, there's a lot of similarities between Arizona, Minnesota, and North Dakota State, and it all comes back to Dick Siebert and a lot of his influence on Coach Kendall. Which a lot of influence on me as well.
Coaching is a calling, I believe. And so, you know, obviously as a young man, you have the dream of wanting to play professional sport, and you actually got a lot closer than most people. But when did you realize that coaching was kind of your calling in life, so to speak?
Well, it's an interesting story. Both of us went to Sabino High School. We're high school friends, and I just got released from the Cleveland Indians, which was by no surprise. You know, I had my four-year degree. I graduated. Here I am in spring training. I'm pitching the next day, and so I'm behind home plate charting, and some 19-year-old youngster comes out, doesn't look like he's in very good shape. First pitch of spring training, I'm recording him with the radar gun and charts. First pitch is 96, then 97, 97, 98. And I turned to the guy next to me and I said, I'm going to have a hard time making this team if this is what 19-year-olds look like.
Right.
And it turns out that was Bartolo Colon.
Oh, wow. Wow.
That was his first spring training and my first spring training. And Bartolo Colon was in. I'm going into my 23rd year of coaching and Bartolo Colon still pitching in the major leagues.
Yep. Just
and
watched
so
him pitch last night.
You start figuring out that you know that professional baseball is a whole different beast. And I just finished playing 5 years, one of them a redshirt year in the Pac-10, and Bartolo Colon was a 19-year-old, was better than anybody that I saw in the Pac-10. Mm-hmm. And so once I got released, I'm you know here I am feeling sorry for myself, walking around the mall. I run into my old high school chemistry teacher, Bruce Johnson, mm-hmm. if you remember him. Is after he's done teaching, he became a high school counselor, and he goes, "Hey, what are you doing?" And, you know, we talk, and he says, you need to come out to the school on Monday. 7 a.m., meet me in the counseling office. All right. On Tuesday, I started as a long-term sub, teacher's aide, and coaching varsity baseball. Wow. Just like that. Wow. He was just a guy that says, you need to be a teacher, you need to be a coach, come out and see me at 7 a.m. on Monday. And I did. And then I started getting into it, and I really liked it. You know, I'm the pitching coach for the varsity team. I'm teaching side-by-side with some of the old teachers that me and you had, and I liked it. The first year we won a state championship, we had a pitcher that was 93, 94, 95, and Chad Sislak. So it was really easy to call pitches when you got a guy throwing 93 miles an hour in high school. The second year, J.J. Hardy of the Orioles and Twins and all the Milwaukee Brewers, he was my shortstop. And so you're thinking,
good player.
That's super, you know, he's a gold glove player, you know, up to $8, $10 million a year his last couple of years. Pretty high level player, and you get to coach him in high school, and it became really fun, and I got addicted to it. It was winning was fun. It was a chance to stay in a uniform, and it kind of grew in from there.
It's hard to look back and think, you know, what if, but let's say you weren't coaching. What do you think you'd be doing?
Honestly, I really don't know. Probably still a teacher.
Yeah.
Is probably something that I probably would still be doing. I'd probably be a teacher. If I wasn't coaching, possibly sales, some kind of outdoor sales. I didn't want a position where I was wearing a suit and tie every day and sit behind a desk inside. It just, if you know me, that would drive me nuts, is to say you have to be here at 8 a.m. and you can't leave till 5 and you only get 1 hour lunch and you have to wear a suit and tie. That would drive me nuts. So something where I was up and active, moving around, not every day is the same, is kind of what drove me into coaching and teaching, and probably still why I'm doing it.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, coaching is teaching. So speaking of that and looking at, you know, academics on the teaching side, obviously, you know, the X's and O's of the game very well. I found it interesting, though, in looking at your track record, you have a history of having very high performing academic teams. You routinely have teams that post, you know, over 3.0 GPAs. You have individuals that achieve academic awards, and you've been recognized as a team for your classroom performance as a group. In a D1 college, how does a coach make that happen? I mean, it seems like a very difficult thing to get your kids to buy into the athletic side as well as the academic side.
Yeah, it is. When I took over here in 2007, GPA was about 2.85, somewhere in that range. Mm-hmm. We miss a lot of school. We miss 20 to 22 days of school in the spring. And now our team GPA is a 3.27. We usually get a 3.2 or higher almost every semester. It all starts in the recruiting process, to be honest with you.
Okay.
When we start the recruiting process, we see thousands and thousands of kids. We go after the best baseball players we can find. Once we find the best baseball players that we think can fit our needs and wants, then we start looking at academics and transcripts, talking to coaches, attitude, all those different things. And then we dwindle that list all the way down to the guys that we start inviting to campus, showing them visits, building relationships over the phone. And then you start to get a sense of whether guys are really interested in you or not. You know, you get six shortstops, you only need one. You start getting a sense of who really is interested and who isn't. But it all starts in the recruiting process. And I always tell guys that cut corners in the classroom are the guys that cut corners on the baseball field. They're the guy that cut corners in their relationships. They're the guy that cuts corners with their friends. So we try to, you know, it's pretty easy to look at a transcript. If a guy is in a high school and getting a 2.4, but his ACT is a 28, that means he's not doing a good job of his in-class stuff. He has the smarts because his test scores are high, but he doesn't have the work ethic because his GPA is low. Right. So we stay away from those guys because it's a red flag. Either he is bored and doesn't want to do it, or, you know, he's going to come in and probably not be successful here because he has the smarts, but he chooses not to do it, and we stay away from those guys. We're looking for guys that have above a 3.0 and above a 21 ACT is kind of our low benchmarks that we're looking for. And then we're looking for guys that overachieve, and we talk about it all the time. Guys come in. We have guys that on our team that have never received a B in their life. And they come into college and boom, A's, A's, A's. If we see a semester when we do grade checks, you got this 4.0 kid that's never received a B in his life. Now he's got two B's and two C's. There's something going on in his life. Maybe there's something at home we don't know about. Maybe he broke up with his girlfriend. Maybe there's some financial issues. Maybe he's going through some depression. So these are signs that we look for. But for the most part, we know exactly what kind of student and expectations once they get here. We have great resources between our academic offices, our counseling, our tutors. Everything is in place for them to be successful, and then we hold them accountable. And before you know it, you put all those things together, and now you have a GPA of 3.27, even though we're missing 22 days of school in the spring.
Well, and one thing you mentioned, Coach, is you look for the best baseball players in the country. And that list starts at thousands and then you pare it down. I know there's a lot of different avenues to find those, but how do you typically find those recruits? Is that by going out to different tournaments? Is that by talking? Is it looking at services? What does that look like?
Yeah, there's some good things, and I have to be careful, you know, with recruiting rules, but sure. We start generally looking at the closest kids to our campus are the easiest to recruit because they understand our school, our weather, our tradition, our state. Usually being closer, friends and family can be involved. They're not too far from home. The costs are usually cheaper because of to and from home to school, cars versus flights, getting home for Thanksgiving, Christmas. So we start around Fargo. And we move about 6 or 8 hours in a car ride in a circle, and we try to look for the best players in those regions. And then there's different scouting services. There's some of the best tournaments in the country are hosted in that region. A lot of them being in the Minneapolis area. We go, we recruit, we talk to college coaches. While we're out, you know, so word starts to spread. We talk to high school coaches. We start to talk to Legion coaches. We talk to professional scouts. Before you know it, you really start growing this list. And then from there, we go out and observe them, watch them, find the right fits, and then start looking into the academic side.
You know, you mentioned the weather. That was one of my coming up questions and talking about the weather and where you coach because you obviously played and went to school in Arizona, you know, we're in Ohio for a number of years, now North Dakota, a little bit harsher climates, but have noticed that when you, you know, people on your roster like Tucker Road from Scottsdale, I mean, how do you sell against a warmer client when, you know, talking to players like that?
Yeah, it's a good piece. You know, Tucker Road, his dad played at Arizona, so there was a connection that way. There was a trust factor. That was built. And one of the first things I talk to kids is from that far away is I'm not going to be able to change the distance from your house. I'm not going to be able to change the weather. If those are going to be an issue, let's talk about it now, and then we can end our conversation so I'm not wasting my time or your time. I can't change. It's Fargo, North Dakota. It's going to be cold and it's going to snow, and we're not going to be able to play in February and March at home. I can't change that. If that's a big deal to you, let's go our separate ways now. And most kids, to be honest with you, they just want a chance to play. You know, there's kids in certain regions where there's just not a lot of Division I options. There's a lot of junior college options, and academically they feel like going to a Division I school is a better fit for them. And to be honest with you, I think there's something about having a place with four seasons that still attracts people. It's different. It's cold here in the wintertime, but I'm telling you, the spring when the weather breaks, it's beautiful. The summer's beautiful. The fall is absolutely gorgeous here. You know, there's something to be said about living in a place that snows when it's Christmas time. So some guys are really attracted to it and it doesn't bother them. So other guys want to stay away from it. And usually most of our kids that have come from far distances, there's usually some kind of connection between maybe a coach or a family member or a grandparent was originally from this school or from this area. There's usually some kind of connection that really draws them to this region to get back to.
And so you mentioned, you know, hey, we're not able to play at home for the first part of the season. I looked and this last year, your first 32 games you were in Texas, Arizona, Florida, Colorado, Oklahoma, Illinois, you were all over the place. Which has got to be grueling. I can only imagine. You mentioned how much time kids are going to be away from the classroom. Above and beyond the game, the grind of that travel, how do you manage that? I mean, does that just come from experience? What does that look like?
Well, this year was probably the worst. In my 11 years, I think this year was the worst. Simply because when we started getting into April, where we usually are playing at home or practicing at home, every time we came back from a road trip, there was more snow on our cars and field than when we left. So it didn't seem like we were getting closer. It looked like we were getting further away from actually playing. So this year was tough. It was a mental challenge. But that's why, again, we start recruiting kids that are 6 to 8 hours or less from here, is because they've grown up in this. They getting a game canceled because of weather or having to go play on the road, that's pretty common for these guys. So they know how to handle it, and they're a little bit more in tune and on how to handle it. You know, it took me a while to get used to it, simply because if you look at Division I, it doesn't matter if you're Florida State or North Dakota State. Go look at road records for Division I schools. No matter if you play 4 or 5 games on the road or 32 straight like we did, is if you play a road game, 17% of Division I schools have a winning road record. So that means you have an 83% chance of losing, having a losing record on the road. Well, when you play 32 straight, we have to find a way to be close to 500. That way, when we start to play home, that we can get above 500 that we've done the last 3 years straight. This year, we're 26 and 24 to finish. A lot of people will say, well, that's not that great. Well, yeah, it is when you play 32 straight on the road. Right. We didn't get buried like some other teams in our region and be 10, 15, 20 games below 500. That way, when you play home, you can never get back to 500. We found a way to just be competitive, aggressive. You know, we find ways to win games on the road. That way we can stay around that 500 number. That way when we get home, now we get home, it's like a rejuvenated new season. And this past year where we went 11-4 at home and totally flipped our, and we're playing our best baseball down the stretch going into the tournament, which is what you want in a program to be able to win championships.
We mentioned earlier, Coach, about your grit, right, and your perseverance and being able to fight through struggles and just kind of want it more than the others. As a, you know, tenured coach now, you've seen lots of athletes. You've seen, you know, blue chip guys come in and bomb out. And you've seen guys that, you know, you probably didn't think they had much of a chance, and they've been a great contributor to your program. So the most common reason that you see that kids don't succeed in college athletics, and I know that it's hard to, you know, pinpoint it to one thing, but if you could, you know, whether that's they quit or they never reach their full potential, what's kind of the thing that doesn't really get that kid over the edge?
That's a tough question because everybody's different. You know, it drives me a little bit nuts when say, you know, oh, back in my day, it was about, well, you know, I'm not sure some of that always holds water, but I can tell you this. It seems like there's just more options out there. There's more distractions, and it's easier to quit than it was 20, 30 years ago. And I think that's a fair statement without blaming individual kids or whatever. There's a lot more options now. You know, example, 20 years ago, we go on the bus, and it was like, hey, did we bring 15 movies so we can watch movies on the bus? Now we get on the bus, and we don't even think about turning the TV on because everybody has their own phones and individual iPads to watch whatever they want, not a team movie, so to speak, while we're traveling. Sure. Kids just have so many more options, and I think they're they have so much more information, and obviously it's translated into it's easier to not stick with things because more things are available nowadays. I think is probably the best way that I could describe it, and I don't know any other way other than, you know, there's a lot of ups and downs in your life, and sports is a direct reflection of life. And I find that the guys that really keep moving up the ladder and are the guys that aren't given everything, that but they still achieve more than what they're supposed to, those are the guys that are going to go on and be a great sales team leader, a CEO, a great teacher, a great coach, whatever profession they go into. Those are the kids that are really being successful, or the kids that use all the information and data that's out there, but still having that grit and that grind on a day-to-day basis to succeed.
Best and worst memories coaching-wise so far in 11 years as a head coach, or could be from an assistant time, but, you know, kind of the best and worst.
Well, you know, there's a couple moments. Worst, we'll start with that first, I guess. Having a 4-run lead from playing in the College World Series and get in the eighth inning and not winning that game against Oklahoma State on the road. That was probably the toughest loss I've ever gone through. And somebody asked me, how long did it take to get over it? And I said, I'll let you know when I do.
Right.
Almost 30 years later is, you know, to have that lead. And, you know, there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that go into your career. And then here it is, you're looking at the scoreboard, you got 4 outs to go, and you got a multi-run lead, and it just slipped away. It was really, really difficult. So that was probably one of my lowlights. Obviously, getting released from the Indians after my Bartolo Colon story, you will know why I got released, but still, when you start playing at 5 years old and then you're 25, 26 years old and you're kind of told you can no longer play, and you know it based on your physical, my arm was not doing well after surgery. I was not back to where I needed to be. And that was a difficult time in my life as well, just knowing that I couldn't play anymore and didn't have the ability to play anymore. Mm-hmm. And some of my highlights coaching-wise is finally getting an opportunity to be a Division I head coach is a big deal. There's only 297 Division I head coaches in the country, and I get to be one of them. So it was an honor to get the job. The job was really tough. We were averaging 12 wins a year. We weren't funded very well. We're in Fargo, North Dakota. There was a lot of things against us, and I got the job. And I tell everybody, the job was so bad that I got the job. And we get to work, and our first recruiting class, by the time that they were seniors, we won 40 games. And I felt like that was one of the best accomplishments, because for 4.5 years, we built that team, and nobody said it was possible, given our weather, our scholarship situation, our coaching staff, the players in our region, every excuse that you could ever think of why it could never happen. And for me to come in and hire a staff that was just relentless in helping me pursue this dream that everybody said could not happen. In our first recruiting class, become seniors, we go to the University of Arizona, my alma mater, beat them. They go on to win a national championship. We go on to win 40 games, school records up and down. And then that kind of parlayed into 13, having another great year. And then in 14, winning the championship, dogpiling in Sioux Falls for the Summit League Tournament Championship, first time in school history, and going to a regional at Oregon State was a pretty special time in my coaching career.
Looking forward, you know, or present day and then going forward, what's the best thing about the college baseball game today, in your opinion? What are you excited about?
I think it's so – college baseball, if you watch it compared to all the other levels that you can watch – it's so pure and innocent. The kids are playing because they really love playing. Go watch the College World Series sometime. Watch the regional action. Mm-hmm. You know, college softball is the same thing. You watch that on TV. You know, the playoffs are on at about the same time. there's such an innocence to it where kids are playing the game for the right reasons. There is no money. Yes, there's scholarships, but there is no money and contracts and all that stuff. That's what's so fun about the game is these kids are not really compensated scholarship-wise like other sports, and they're still doing it at a high level and having fun doing it. And that spirit, that college spirit, really motivates me to come to work every day, is because we got a lot of kids that, you know, they're on 25 to 30% scholarships, and they're working 7 days a week to be a Division I baseball player, and it's really fun to see their growth.
So on the flip side of that, Coach, with all the highlights and the good things, the pure part of it, what worries you the most about college baseball in the future, if anything?
Well, I think, you know, some of the new transfer rules are concerning to me, where if kids can start transferring at free will, that will turn North Dakota State into nothing more than a junior college. This will just be breeding ground for me to go do a bunch of hard work and dig through the sticks of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Canada, go find really good players that nobody else can find, and then they come here and turn out to be something, and then all of a sudden now they can go to Florida State or LSU because they're better than they developed more than other people thought. I think that's concerning. Sends the wrong message that you can go ahead and get really, really good and then just dump your team. I'm hoping that doesn't go through. Professional baseball is always concerning. The money's getting really, really high for these kids to be given opportunities to play professional baseball. And a lot of times they're not ready. They need more development. A lot of kids are getting opportunities to play pro ball that shouldn't. They need to wait a little bit longer, but the money's too good, so they don't have any really options. And then they get into pro ball and they're not ready, and they're asked to perform and do things that they're not physically or mentally ready to do, where college can help develop that. And that's concerning as well, because the money is just getting too good for these guys to say no, and they really aren't ready to handle that.
Right, right. Well, I know we're coming up on our time, and I want to be very aware of your time and sensitive to that. I was thinking of a way to kind of get a phrase or a motto in for you, and so I came up with an. If you're required by the state of North Dakota by law to place a permanent bumper sticker on your vehicle, and this bumper sticker transfers vehicle to vehicle, whether you get a new one or what, but you're going to drive this every day until the end of your life, what's that bumper sticker going to say?
Well, something that I tell my team before big games or stressful moments that have seemed to work. It says, relax, have fun, and play, and let the chips fall where they may.
Mm-hmm. Good. It's good. I didn't know if you were going to go with that or what you said earlier, which was head, heart, guts, and nuts, which I thought was pretty impressive too. So
yeah, that I've used that one quite a bit, is because it's true. If you have those four things, it's hard to lose when you have those four things going for you.
Well, Coach, I really appreciate you taking the time. I knew you years ago, and I'm very, very proud of what you've done. I watching you from afar, and I wish you the best of luck this summer. And hopefully on the recruiting trail and as you get ready for spring next year.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks. Appreciate it.